A controversial plan to reduce traffic congestion, does it have a chance? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Fort Lauderdale City Commissioners are voting tonight on the controversial WAVE streetcar project. But here's the kicker. Five candidates running for commission seats have signed a pledge to undo an approval if the plan passes tonight. Miami's North Biscayne Boulevard was once a tourist paradise. Fanciful motels had names like Shalimar and Vagabond, but then all of it fell into disrepair for years. We talked to a developer who is restoring the faded glory along the boulevard. And the history of Overtown, we get a sneak peek at a walk through one of Miami's most culturally significant neighborhoods. That's all coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, city commissioners in Fort Lauderdale are going to be voting tonight on whether to move forward with the controversial WAVE streetcar project. Last week, the Fort Lauderdale Downtown Development Authority, or DDA, gave its blessing to the WAVE. The Broward County Commission has to as well. But now, five of the six candidates running for city commission seats have signed a pledge to kill the project, even if it passes tonight. We're joined now by the DDA board chairman, Alan Hooper. Mr. Hooper, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. So let's start with this. Why do you believe that the city of Fort Lauderdale needs the WAVE streetcar?
I believe that the WAVE is part of a bigger picture. You know, when you combine planning with transportation, which has rarely been the case in the past, you start deciding where the next wave of development will occur, and you try to plan it along a line, and then you try to include people movers so that it's done in an organized and an efficient manner. And the WAVE is just the beginning of a system that the county is going to implement over the next so many years that will connect downtown to the westport part of the county, to the airport, to the seaport, to Nova Southeastern. It makes smart sense to do something like this. And here we are with in the 11th hour, and we have the funding set up for it, and it's ready to go.
So what's your take on this news now that there's a pledge by city commission candidates who say that they're going to kill the project, even if the current commission votes for it tonight?
Well, I can't speak to what someone else is going to do in the future, but I can tell you that when I voted for Jack Seiler or my city commissioner, I voted for them to spend their entire term as the leaders and the visionaries of our Fort Lauderdale. And so their term doesn't end until March, and right now there's a vote in front of them, and they have to make their best decision. As a matter of fact, these particular commissioners have been sitting on the commission for some of them over 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So they're not neophytes. They are experienced, and they've been dealing with issues that the city has had to deal with, and this is one of those. And so they are still in office, and I consider their vote as real as any other vote. And I think that when a city makes a commitment, and when we have partners at the table like the county and FDOT and the FTA and the DDA, all sitting at the table, and there's been a vote and an agreement to move forward, turning that agreement around at a later date is irresponsible, in my opinion.
But it's got to concern you, and also the fact that the two mayoral candidates, who will be voted in March, Bruce Roberts and Dean Trantalis, both of them commissioners, they're against it.
I can't speak to why they're against it, and I can't speak to how they're going to react in March.
Do you need to have a new strategy to get support for this project? Do you have to go through that all over again if you have a new commission come in?
Well, I'm in the real estate business, and when I sign a contract or when I make an agreement or when I assign or take on a business that's made agreements in the past, I live with them. So I can't speak to a city commission that is that may, for political reasons, decide to go against an agreement that the city that they're representing has already agreed to.
Are you confident that
they I can't be considered. I can't be concerned with those kind of things.
Okay. Are you confident that this commission then is going to vote for the Wave Streetcar tonight?
I'm hopeful they do. I'm hopeful. I think that we've made some pretty compelling arguments as to why it's important from a big picture standpoint. People have the right to their opinion. The DDA has been working on this for quite a while, and the DDA is not just developers. We represent a restaurant owner, a civil rights attorney, a land use attorney, a couple of developers, and two professionals, one of which manages the Los Olas company and the retail and the other good things that people love so much about downtown. So we have skin in the game, and we are looking to do something that's positive and that is good, and we hope that the city commission that's sitting tonight will agree with us.
You know, the idea of the streetcar, I mean, this project is not new. I mean, it's been around since, what, 2004, 2005?
That's right.
Why is it taking this long to get to this point?
Because it's not a private endeavor. I mean, that's the way government projects go. It takes time, and that reinforces the reason why we should continue forward is because we've worked so hard to bring the federal government and FDOT, the transit money that's available and those from those two agencies to the table, who are coming to the table with 75% of the money, and here we are, ready to say no to them. And people say, well, we can spend that money doing it using different technology or using it elsewhere. No, that money's going to go to another city in some other state that's going to say, I'll take that, and we will put in a light rail system. Light rail, I mean, all you have to do is get on Brightline and take it to Clematis or to when it opens up to Miami. I've been on it. It's the same product. It's a Siemens train, and it's modern. It's super modern. And it feels like you're sitting in a Ferrari. It's beautiful. So this opportunity comes once in a lifetime, and I think we're going to continue to move forward with it, hopefully.
Now, you've heard the arguments, though. You've heard people say, well, some people are not fans of having, you know, the rail in the roads. They're not fans of the wires. They're not fans. You're talking about the streetcars like we've seen in other cities. Some people don't like those. Have you spoken to any of those detractors? I mean, how do you answer to those issues that they have?
My life has been dedicated towards redeveloping blighted areas, Flagler Village. I've been here for 20 years. I can listen to folks that have a difference of opinion. But overhead lines, I would say that the overhead lines that are running all over the streets are more of a distraction than anything than this would be. And rails, once they're set into the asphalt, you're not going to see those rails. And I hear the thought that maybe a bicycle wheel might get stuck in it. But when I was riding 50 miles a day, I was looking where my wheel was going, and there were a lot more hazards that were there via the curb or the sidewalk or a ramp or other things that if I didn't keep my eye on the road, that I could have crashed. So the idea that this technology is old, well, tell that to Salt Lake City County, Utah, who have just been one phase after the next have been continuing to grow theirs. Say that to Atlanta, who just put in a streetcar in their downtown. Now, when the technology gets improves, when batteries, just like the battery in your phone, gets to a point where it's improved to where it's cost effective, we can plug and play that right into the streetcar and take the catenary lines down. But right now we have the opportunity, and getting in the back of the line is not an option.
Remind everybody again, at least this first leg of the streetcar, where would it go? From where to where? It's almost 3 miles long, correct?
Right. It would go from basically the northern portion of Flagler Village across the center of the Los Olas and Financial District and onto the North Broward Hospital.
And again, the city commission votes tonight. They've already had, some preliminary votes, and it was a close one. It was 5-4, I believe. Mm-hmm. Have you spoken to any commissioners? Do you have any reason to believe that any of them might switch their votes?
Are you talking about the county?
I'm sorry. Yeah, it was the county. Actually, you're right. But do you have any reason to believe that it's not going to go your way tonight?
Well, so the county just voted 5-4.
That was
so
the county. You're correct.
County,
yes.
Right. And so the city is going to hear it tonight. And I read an op-ed from Jack Seiler that I thought showed an incredible amount of leadership and vision and really broke down the issues succinctly. I thought he showed the leader that he's been for the last 9 years, and I hope someday he'll take office somewhere else, because I think the guy shows an incredible amount of vision. So I think that I'm hoping that we have our votes tonight, and at the end of the day, what we're talking about is an amenity for downtown Fort Lauderdale, and it's a bonus. It's not like something horrible has happened where we should be marching on City Hall, or that our community should be dividing over this. Win, lose, or draw, tonight, at the end of the day, I go back to doing what I do, and my neighbors and my fellow citizens, I still love them. And so I think that this is not the kind of issue that should be dividing us the way it is. I don't know where it came from. I don't know where the politics came from, but this shouldn't be drawing as much emotion as it is, but it is. So. But when it's done, when it's all said and done after this vote, I will still embrace my fellow Fort Lauderdale neighbors.
And you're correct. I do apologize. It was the county commission that had voted 5-4. They voted for it. Mm-hmm. Again, the DDA has already given its blessing. The city commission, Fort Lauderdale City Commission, will be discussing that and voting on it tonight. And, of course, we'll be tracking that vote as well. Alan Hooper, again, is the board chairman for the DDA. That is the Fort Lauderdale Downtown Development Authority. And we've been talking about the WAVE streetcar project. Again, federal money's already in for this project. So what happens next? And again, you can share your thoughts on our website. You can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or on Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts. Mr. Hooper, thank you so much. We'll have you back. We can discuss the future of this project. We'll see what happens in tonight's vote.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Well, coming up, we are going to talk to one of Miami's top developers about how she finds her next big projects. What is the next big project in Miami? It's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so imagine if you're a tourist visiting Miami back in the 1950s. You know, not all of the action was on Miami Beach. Biscayne Boulevard on mainland Miami was lined with fanciful motels. They had neon signs and exotic names like Shalimar and Sinbad. Then the street and the motels became less popular. They fell into disrepair. Some were even slated for demolition. But a few developers appreciated what's now known as MIMO's style. One of them is my next guest, Average Jane. She's best known for restoring the Vagabond Motel, changing it from an eyesore to a centerpiece of what's now called the MIMO District. Average Jane, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? You started on Wall Street. And I'm just wondering, why did you switch from that to developing real estate?
So that's always a popular question. Wall Street was my day job. My night job, I would moonlight and would always be looking for my next apartment, where I was going to live, where I was going to move within New York City. And so, you know, that's where I would spend my time and my efforts and my free time. And what was a hobby really became a second career.
All right. So what was the first property that, I guess, was a hobby? What was the first property you invested in?
I bought a studio apartment in the West Village on Perry Street. It was a 5-story walk-up. It was about 320 square feet, I think. And
a closet, basically.
But I tell you, it's a... I think Miami would call it micro housing. We called it studio apartments, and it felt like a mansion, of course, at the time. So that's how it started for me. And I always sort of gravitated towards, you know, vintage properties. So I've always had a bug for older buildings.
What did you end up doing with that?
I renovated it, you know, I redid the kitchen and redid the bathroom, and that was really how I got started. I think, you know, for a lot of people who've tried to do their own home renovations, in some way they became, you know, a developer for just a brief moment, and they either had a bad experience and never did it again. In my case, I had a great experience, and so that apartment then became my next home, was a loft in Soho, and then one loft became two, became half a building, and then I left Wall Street.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, like, at what point did you say, you know what, day job, forget that, my hobby is my life now?
Yeah, so I you know, I worked around, you know, a lot of other guys on the street, and so my peers at Goldman Sachs were like, hey, Avra, we want to play too. Let's do a project together. So I left to do a 100,000 square foot loft conversion in North Tribeca, a property that I had identified, an old storage building. And I went to develop that site with, you know, some of my friends and peers, and never went back.
When did you come to Miami, and why?
I've been coming to Miami since the mid 80s. And back when it was, you know, the Manipulator magazine had, you know, in the Century Hotel, and when the Versace mansion was still an apartment building, right? So I've been coming then, and I've been coming since, you know, 1985. A lot of my friends were in fashion, so I'd come hang out with them. And I'd say it was about 1999 that I moved down. December 99 is when I moved from New York City. I was dating somebody here at the time. And I was like, okay, so I could sell my two-bedroom loft apartment and buy a house on the water. That would seem like a no-brainer. So I moved, and I thought I'd go back to New York more than I did, but that was it.
When did you start viewing Miami, though, as that opportunity for investing and reviving properties?
So where I was living on the Venetian Islands at the time, and there was talk of the Performing Arts Center. So I was driving not too far from here, and there was a building that was right across from where the Performing Arts Center was supposed to be. And I was like, oh, I wonder if I could buy that. And I called up, and sure enough, I could. And so between 2000 and 2003, I actually assembled 4 city blocks around the Performing Arts Center, and then to do a big development called Opus. That never happened because of an eminent domain taking in 2005. So I'm very fond of sort of the, you know, the Omni Overtown area. That was really where I did my first investing.
All right. Then you ended up in what is now the MIMO area. Describe it for people who don't know it. Explain what's so appealing about it.
So the district, and big credit to people before me who actually got the boulevard historically designated, which was a lot of work. It took about 8 years for them to do that. So between the streets are 51st to 77th Street, up and down on the Biscayne Boulevard, also known as US 1. It was an assemblage of old motels and buildings from the 50s and 60s, mostly 50s and 60s. Back in the day when people would take US 1 to the, quote, magic city, which was Miami. So for people who couldn't afford to maybe stay at the Fontainebleau or the Eden Rock on the beach, Biscayne Boulevard, the mid-century area of Biscayne Boulevard, was the alternative. So it was these sort of kitschy motor hotels with the neon signs that, you know, as the cars were driving down by on US 1, you know, pick me, pick me. And so it was, you know, the architecture is still sort of that classic mid-century modern tropical, very similar to what you might find in like Palm Springs in California. And thankfully, you know, enough of it's been saved so that the character still remains.
Tell us about The Vagabond and when the first time was you laid eyes on it.
I laid eyes on The Vagabond, it would have been the spring of 2012. And I drove by. It was empty and abandoned at the time. In fact, it was up for demolition. And there was an old rusty for sale sign on it. And I called the for sale sign. And sure enough, it was available. And I purchased it, I think, in October 2012. and we spent 6 months getting permits and we completed it in October 2014.
But what was it when you saw it? This is it's up for demolition, for heaven's sakes. And as you said, I mean, it was kind of a mess. But what is it that you see that makes you think, no, there's something here?
That's a good question. I think people ask me, Avra, how do you pick properties? I always say properties pick me. So I think there was the mermaid was at that time buried at the bottom of the pool under construction debris. And I think she just was calling out my name. The property itself was large scale. There were some things about it that just, some people call it feng shui or whatever. I don't know exactly. You know, we just call it, there's just thing that when you're on the property, the energy just, sort of takes you over.
And by the way, let me stop you. This mermaid. Yeah. Explain that one. People haven't been, they didn't see it. What are you talking about?
So there is there's a mosaic of a mermaid at the bottom of the pool, and we had seen it in many of the postcards. In fact, a lot of people who come back and visit the hotel, it's very emotional for them if they had, because as children, many people had staycations at the Vagabond back in the 50s and 60s. And they'll say to me, Avra, I learned how to swim here. And the mermaid's still there at the bottom of the pools. We had to rebuild the mermaid, but the dolphins are the original dolphins. We actually dug out the pool, and thankfully, the mosaics were still there.
Hey, you can turn anything into, a beautiful property, but location. I mean, where it was located, that, why did you think it could work, and was that difficult?
Yeah, I look back at it sometimes, and I'm not sure what I was thinking at the time. I mean, and of course, now it looks so obvious to everybody. But so remember, the neighborhoods around it were already, had gone through a renaissance. So you had Morningside, Bellmead. So you had affluent neighborhoods or stabilized neighborhoods around it. It was really just the boulevard that had gone into sort of disrepair. And so it was about bringing back Main Street. But the neighborhood itself around it was actually, there was a lot of renovations and restorations already going on. People had already moved back into the neighborhoods, a lot of families. So when I saw Biscayne Boulevard, it wasn't like I was having to recreate something. It was something that had already been there once before. So it was just about dusting it off and bringing it back. I think that the reason why I felt comfortable doing that was because of the historic designation. Because what you don't want to do is put a lot of effort into restoring a vintage building, and then somebody next to you knocks a building down and puts in a shopping mall or whatever, a strip mall. I mean, certainly those things exist, but what you don't want to do is be the only building there. Because what makes it interesting and sort of relevant is really the assemblage of these buildings up and down the boulevard and the history that represents.
Again, I'm talking with Avra Jain. She is best known for restoring the Vagabond Motel, which is what we've been talking about, and of course the famous mermaid, for some of you who remember that, changing it from this eyesore to the centerpiece of what's now called the MIMO District. We're going to take a quick break and continue talking about what it means to restore some of these old properties in South Florida, and maybe I'll get a secret from her on how she spots them. She says the properties pick her. Maybe there's something more to it. We'll have more on this conversation on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio by Avra Jain. Again, she is best known for restoring the Vagabond Motel. And, we're talking a little bit about just restoring some of these old properties and bringing some of that history back to Miami. But also, I want to talk about that style that was what made Miami really famous. Because we talked about MIMO's not just a district. It's not just a physical, geographical area. It is actually a style, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, how do you describe it to people?
So MIMO actually stands for Miami Mid-Century Modern. It's very, back in the day, they call it sort of a motor architecture. So you think of the old diners and you think of the old motor motels. It was a little bit you know, playful, especially in the tropics. There's some distinctive features, architectural features about it. You know, it's the eyebrows, it's the colors, of course, the neon signs, which are very important. And, you know, at the same time, you had sort of the deco period on the beach, and this was sort of the more the mid-century, which you'll find on Biscayne or maybe up in North Beach. We also did the Miami River Inn, which was built in 1908, 1909, which was sort of wood vernacular. So Miami, it's a young city, so we don't have, you know, sort of the depth of some of the older cities like New York or Boston. But what we do have, it's important that we save it because it sort of creates that sense of place.
So when you're working on any property, you know, how much of it is, first of all, I want to know how much of the design are you involved in, or you know, how much do you put your hands in what you're trying to do?
Well, with the historic properties, you're trying to preserve what's there. So you're actually doing a lot of research and just, so on the outside, at least, we're trying to be true to the original architecture of the building. Sometimes it's hard to know what that is because over the years, sometimes the facades get bastardized with renovations and restorations. So we do a lot of research and try to be true to the original architecture. There's a palette of colors, there's a palette of details that are, you know, considered significant, and we try to maintain those. What happens on the inside can change. So, for instance, the South Pacific Motel, which we renovated, by the way, that's my favorite neon sign if you're driving by at night. On the outside, it looks like a motel, looks like the 20-room motel that it was. But on the inside, it's actually a single office use. We have an advertising company called The Community. We have a single office user. So on the inside, all the walls are taken down, and it's like an open, very co-working type office space. So what's on the outside and what's on the inside can be different than what the original use was, which is, I think, a good story to preservation, because I think people get the impression sometimes when you do historic preservation that, you know, your hands are tied and that you can't, you know, it's a liability to the property. But that's not the case at all. I actually think it's an asset. Again, especially if you're in a district, the fact that everybody else around you has to follow design criteria sort of protects your property. And just knowing, but people should understand that it's really about the outside. What happens on the inside, there's a lot of flexibility so that you can make, you know, an older property relevant today.
I wanted to know your thoughts on what is the responsibility of a developer when you're going into an existing neighborhood, and even if it is a historic building and you're trying to, you know, renovate it but bring it back to life. What is a developer's responsibility to that neighborhood and the current residents living in that neighborhood? Because sometimes when you have these kind of things, you beautify something. And then, of course, what that's doing is it's bringing in a certain clientele that wasn't coming in before, which could also mean you're pushing out people, too. And the word gentrification comes up. But, I mean, I don't know. How do developers approach this? How are you supposed to approach this?
That's a it's a really good question. And so we'll take it into sort of, we'll talk about it with regards to sort of what I do. And then I'll speak on behalf of sort of development in general. So, remember, so this was an area, Biscayne Boulevard. I remember the motel I bought next door, which was the Royal, which original name is the Noxon, which we'll bring back. The sign at the front in the lobby was no refunds after 5 minutes. And in fact, it had said 10 minutes and they whited it out to five. So this was an area where people were paying, you know, $20 an hour and $60 a night. If that's gentrification, then I think people were very much appreciative of that. So especially the moms that were driving their kids to school and having to, you know, tint their windows because of the activities on the streets. So in some cases, you know, bringing, cleaning up, you know, getting needles off the play park and allowing for parents to walk their kids in the neighborhood or walk them to school, I mean, that's progress, right? That's transition. You could classify it as gentrification. That was actually a challenge because I couldn't, when I, you know, convinced my family and friends to do this venture with me, what made me think I could do a boutique hotel in an area where it was $20 an hour? So, I mean, it was a it was not an easy sell, I can tell you that. But so I think, you know, those kinds of changes, bringing safety and wellness to a neighborhood is good. You know, on the topic of gentrification, which is, you know, a broader topic, you know, where do you cross the line? I think that's where policy, you know, makers and political leaders have to help try to manage that situation. But one thing to always point out that when a developer comes in, there has to be a willing seller. There's a willing buyer and a willing seller. And what I encourage communities to do is talk with each other as a neighborhood and decide not to sell, right? So it's not really, is it the buyer's fault for a neighborhood changing or is it the seller's fault? So I think that, and then there's policies like, you know, upzoning and all these sorts of things which can encourage things like that. But, you know, it's a complicated and broader topic, but there is some good that comes out of this.
Let's talk about another big issue here in Miami. You know well, affordable housing, and this is something you've been working on. Tell us about that.
Yes, we're working on two projects under the County Surtax Program under Mr. Liu and his team in Little Haiti. He actually, as he would say, pursued me into doing some of this work. It was taking existing product that, you know, from the 50s and 60s, which we have a lot of in, you know, Little Haiti, Overtown, even Little Havana. In Little Havana, it's even 30s and 40s. You know, how can we take some of the existing inventory and that has gone into sort of disrepair and upgrade it to really, you know, proper living conditions, right? Even better than proper. Should be nice. And so we undertook the challenge. It's one of the things that was important to us was not to displace people or relocate people. So we were able to renovate units one at a time and move people around so that, you know, so they could stay on property the whole time. And so we just completed our first project at 6820 Northwest 2nd Avenue. And it's really cute, and the tenants stayed in place. It's challenging because, you know, and again, how do the numbers work, right? So there's two sides of affordable housing. There's sort of two things. One is sort of the deliverable side, like how do you construct and build nice housing that's affordable, and then you will have the social service side, which is you know, how people are, you know, need extra services in terms of job placement, financial planning, maybe healthcare and all the other things. So on the deliverable side, it's pretty black and white. I mean, it's, you know, construction is not rocket science. It is materials, and you should be picking the right materials, good materials, and then there's the labor, right, which is you should be paying people, you know, fair wages, and the scope of work. So it's not really a mystery. The question is how do you fund it?
And of course, you know, one of the challenges is, and Miami is not the most expensive place, but one of the challenges to this city and this region, I think, in South Florida, is the fact that wages are not high enough for a lot of people to afford the housing. That's the complicated part then. You kind of touched on just there. So, I mean, how are we going about this? How should we go about this?
Well, I mean, the good news is that I think the political leaders have recognized this and taken, and actually the voters did in the Miami Forever Fund. They voted for, you know, in the bond raise, there's $100 million allocated for affordable housing. And I was at a CRA meeting in Omni, and, you know, Commissioner Russell pushed ahead an initiative to add another $100 million to that fund, and Commissioner Hardeman and Gort supported that. So I think you have the CRAs that are well-funded due to the success of the development. So the developers do contribute to funds for affordable housing through Surtax and through other, you know, sort of policies that are in place.
Yeah, because you mentioned, too, a little while ago, one of the challenges is funding. So I'm wondering, you know, where are we supposed to be looking then?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the funding's there now. The funding's there, and I think the will to change it is there. Like I said, I think the CRAs, they've both made it a top priority. There's good leadership at both Omni and Overtown CRA. So I think that also Commissioner Croyo has made, you know, suggested he's got an initiative for affordable housing in Little Venice. So it's really the political leaders now that decide. So you have all this money, and there's actually a lot of money. So the question is how are they going to spend it? And all I would urge for listeners and for the community is just, we want transparency, I think. Again, building affordable housing is pretty black and white. All of us developers know what it costs, you know, to do this and scope of work. So I think it's just about having transparency, and you know, and then hoping that the social service side of this will help place the right people in that housing.
Let me finish up with this. Just coming back and taking a look at the big picture, you know, what you've accomplished here in Miami. I just want your thoughts on really where Miami is going. And, you know, we can discuss how they're just constant construction. Towers are going up all over the place. Housing, though, is going up. I don't know. For you and your position, what do you see in South Florida? And do you think this is the market you want to stay in? Or do you think eventually, like you left New York, well, you're going to go find greener pastures somewhere else someday?
Miami's definitely home. And I think it's pretty green, or actually probably pretty blue, right?
Okay,
so,
all right.
So I'm actually very bullish on Miami as a community. I think that, you know, I've seen it change a lot. I mean, I'm not a native, but I've been coming here for a long time. And I think the fact that we have these neighborhoods that are these sort of submarkets, these other neighborhoods, it's not just about Miami Beach anymore, like back in the 80s, and, you know, we talked about. And so you have, like, you know, Little Haiti, Little Havana, you know, you have the historic Overtown districts, you have all these pockets of cultural pockets. And I think it's the diversity that's so attractive about Miami, and that's sort of turned us from a town into sort of a city. I think arts and culture has certainly led the way, and I think that, you know, Miami still has a lot of opportunity. I think I'm really encouraged by the young people that are here and the entrepreneurship. We maybe don't have a Fortune 500 company, but maybe we'll build one. And I think we're seeing a lot of people that had left Miami come back. So I think that's, you know, those are all things that I look as being positive. And I think there's leadership in place that could really elevate Miami to next level.
Again, I've been talking with developer Avra Jain. She's best known for restoring the Vagabond Motel. Just getting an idea, the story of, you know, really where Miami has been and where it's going. Avra Jain, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet a woman who has some fascinating stories to share about Overtown. Yeah, we'll keep talking about neighborhoods here in Miami. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Now, we're going to talk about the history of an even more famous Miami neighborhood, Overtown. It's one of the oldest parts of the city and was once known as the Harlem of Miami. My next guest, Gail Willingham, is a teacher and a performer, and she's going to lead her annual history walk through Overtown this weekend. Gail, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, tell us about this walk. First of all, you go through a number of different parts of the community, and there's a lot that's going on. It's not just a walk. It's almost like a show.
Well, I actually want to correct you. It's going to be 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now. Well, okay. Thank you. Okay, good.
And we have incorporated, since we started, some music and drama, because that's my zone. I'm in the zone when I do that. And it allows us to use the stories of the people, which I think is at the very heart of why Overtown is such a historic place.
When did you first start doing these?
We did the first walk in 2015, and a group of us who were in the choir at my church wanted to do outreach. One of the things that I thought would be nice is to start the touring of the historic places that we used to know before they all disappear.
Right.
I'm hoping they're not going to disappear now, but we used to grow up and we would go to these places, to the restaurants, we would go to the houses. We would go to the theaters, and we wanted to tour those and just walk in the streets and walk together with the people who are still there.
And who are some of the folks that you've met along the way who've taken this tour, who've taken this walk with you?
Well, we have a couple that came last year, 2 years ago and last year, Julie and her husband Brady, and they were taking pictures because they wanted to support that, and they're from Miami Beach. We've also had a lot of the people in the International Longshoremen Group who have one of the stops on our walk to continue to be there because they're still working, and a lot of the members of the churches that are still serving the community of Overtown.
You know, ever since, and anybody doesn't know the history, but, and I'm not going to pretend that I do. I'm just, it's what I've read and understand, because I'm still kind of a newbie to Miami, but, you know, is that there was such a rich history a long time ago. And then, of course, you had the construction of the highways, cuts right through, and it displaced people. Families
yes.
were, you know, they,
yes.
their homes destroyed because, well, we got to build this highway.
Yes.
That changed everything after that. Overtown was different after that. What do people get wrong about Overtown?
Well, I think when you hear that and they have a stereotype in their mind of the type of neighborhood that it may be from the news or from reading about it or hearing things on television, makes it seem like not a very good place to be. And I want to provide with this walk the idea that the people who are there and things that have happened there have happened everywhere. And we're just going to walk together because we've all been through good times and bad times. And let's start focusing on what we can come together on instead of splitting apart.
By the way, and for those who don't know, let's describe where Overtown is. What are the boundaries?
Well, that's a good question, because in our minds, it used to be from 20th, Northwest 20th Street to Northwest 6th Street, Northwest 7th Avenue, the present 7th Avenue corridor, all the way over to Northwest 2nd Avenue.
Overtown has been a lot in the news a lot, I should say, recently because of two big projects. One is the Brightline train.
Yes.
And they're going to be building, you know, the big station in part of Overtown.
Yes.
And of course, the other one is the soccer stadium.
Yes.
So David Beckham announced that there will be a team, though they don't know yet if their stadium is going to be in Overtown. What are the folks of Overtown saying about all of this? I mean, are they, I know there are people who are against the stadium, but what are people just saying in general about what's coming? Or could be coming.
Well, you have different opinions. Just like you have different opinions everywhere, there are people who have their own opinions about, well, this is going to be great. I can walk to see a game at the soccer stadium, hopefully, if it's in that area. Or there are people who are saying, well, I want to be able to travel through and to do what I've done all the time without being, you know, in a jam or rush. And so I'm saying to myself, we have to really consider what the whole view is of what is good for the community, not only historically from the people who there, but the people who are there now, what is good for the neighborhood. And then we have to make sure we're in touch with our politicians and our leaders so they know our opinions. As I say, they're varied, and they will, you know, continue to represent the people who have those opinions.
Again, I'm talking with Gail Willingham, a teacher and performer. She's doing her annual history walk through Overtown. That's in 2 weeks. I get
yes.
that right?
Yes.
You know what? Let's talk a little bit about some of the places that you go and some of the history that you remind people about. This walk begins at the historic Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church.
My church.
Yes. And a lot of history. What's so historic about this place?
This church began right before the incorporation of the city of Miami, which was in 1896. Some of the very members who are our charter members were those people who voted for the incorporation. I don't think a lot of people realize how many black people, people of color, were there at the time, and that we were some of the very energetic and current people who have families still here today from those descendants. There's a lady at our church who has a charter member that was there in 1896. And we'd like to trace the people. We want to do that because if it's a way that people can connect to people, then they're going to be able to feel better and safer about the whole neighborhood. It's not just the buildings. It's not the land. We want to know what happened to people who were living there, who worked there. I have met in the 3 years that we've done the walk previously, a man who worked there, and he is now the oldest living member or the person who is the only living member of the Platters, which is a famous group. I have met there the couple who met for the first time and got engaged and everything in front of the Dorsey house because her great aunt was living in the residence. So it's very exciting, you know, if you can get the people stories behind it.
And you know what? What are some of the other spots that you go to that, you know, that you have this kind of excitement about that are really unique that people should know about?
They should know about the Lyric Theater and the wonderful things that have gone on there. And I think, you know, that's one of the jewels that we have that is still preserved and is still currently available for us for the arts and culture. They should know about the Black Police Precinct Museum.
This is interesting because this, going back many mm-hmm. decades, there was a police department and a court. And it was the only
one of the first in the whole country that was catering to the blacks,
right?
To black people. They had their own judge, their own jail, and the five police officers who were called patrolmen at that time were in 1944 were patrolling the Overtown area. And so we're going to be stopping there and also at the new place on 3rd Avenue, which is another street that's becoming alive with a whole lot of businesses and restaurants, is Jackson Soul Food. And
we've had them on the show recently. Yeah.
And that's wonderful because I can personally testify to the menu. And that has always been the way that was before, you know, today. It's from the time that they opened.
So real quickly, you know what? Everyone's invited. Just tell them real quickly how they can find out about it and to be a part of it.
Good. This is a free walk. We're going to be there on Saturday, February 17th, 10 a.m. to noon. We'll be walking starting at the historic Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church, 301 Northwest 9th Street, and ending at Jackson Soul Food Restaurant, which is just like down the corner from the church. So we're going in a sort of a crooked circle.
All right. Now, Gail Willingham, again, teacher, performer. She's doing this annual history walk through Overtown. We'll make sure we get all that information up on our website so you can find out more about it. Everyone is invited. You're going to have the opportunity to get a taste of the history of this fascinating community that a lot of times we don't even think about.
And hear a lot about the stories and why people who are still here know so much of why it should be preserved and why it is historic. Because they were there.
Gail Willingham, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And have a great walk.
Good. Thank you.
Again, we'll have that information up on our website. That's our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Coming up tomorrow, Palm Beach County Schools just lost their superintendent, Robert Avosa, is taking another job. We'll find out more about that. Also, we're going to meet a teacher with the Miccosukee Tribe. How is their education system different from everyone else's? That's all coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember, you can find us on iTunes. Just look up WLRN Sundial. Find us on Facebook, again, WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts on anything that you've heard on the show. And remember, always share it if you love it. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll talk to you tomorrow.